and Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us a lady local to my area, Patricia Carizzi Howell, an herbalist. And I kind of found her at the last minute because I ran across her a few weeks ago at a festival and just thought I'd like to have her on and start learning something about herbs. We've never discussed that on my program before, so it's Tom. How are you, Patricia?
I'm doing great, Eva. Nice to be here.
Thanks for coming on my show, especially at such short notice.
My
I'm excited to have you, but I think we talked about you got to come back when I get your book and I can go through it and do a better job.
Okay.
So before we get started, tell me a little bit about you and how you got to do what you're doing and where people can find you.
Okay. Well, I guess what I would be considered is a medical herbalist, which means I kind of use that term medical to distinguish from someone who's a craft person using plants. And I have a clinical practice. I see clients and make recommendations for herbal remedies for them in Atlanta and in the North Georgia Mountains. And I also have a school for people to come and study herbal medicine. The approach that I take in my classes in particular is using the regional plants. I don't know if you know this, but the Southern Appalachians, which extend into North Georgia, are one of the most botanically rich places in the world. And in addition to having a lot of plant diversity, there's an unusually large number of plants in this area that have a traditional use as medicine. So I take people out. In fact, I was out all day today in the National Forest teaching people how to identify some of the medicinals in this area. I have a website for my school, which is called Botanologos, and that's kind of an unusual name, but it's the word in Greek. I'm Greek, which means someone who speaks for the plants. And I have a website, www.wildhealingherbs.com.
How do you spell the Botanologos so they can find that?
Well, it's actually pretty simpler than it looks, but whenever you get a lot of syllables together, people's minds kind of go blank, but it's B-O-T-A-N-O, like botany, B-O-T-A-N-O-L-O-G-O-S.
And is your email, can they contact you on these websites?
It's info@wildhealingherbs.com.
Okay. What got you on this path? Just curious.
Well, I was, I would say, being a hippie in my teens. I became interested in, like many people who are now middle-aged, in sort of the back-to-the-land movement, and I started to look for books about plants. I grew up in northern Illinois and started to teach myself how to identify wildflowers, and then realized that a lot of the plants that grew in the prairie areas around where I grew up were actually things that had a long history of medicinal use, which at the time just really blew my mind, that flowers could be medicine. So I started, I'm sorry to say, experimenting on my sisters with herbs and mixing things up and getting, because I was the oldest, getting them to drink things. And just became totally fascinated with it. Of course, never occurred to me that that would be something someone would do for their work. And I ended up going to college and studying film and television production, and worked in the music business as a sound engineer and as a technical producer for large outdoor events until I was in my early 30s. And at that time, some things changed in my life that made me sort of think, oh, I am not going to live forever. What is it that I really want to be doing? And I had, during all of that time, still been working with plants, self-taught. I had come up with a really fabulous menstrual cramp formula that I sold to my friends. And I went to a class by an herbalist named David Hoffman in San Francisco, And he happened to mention that he was getting ready to start a year-long training program in Northern California. And I went home that night and sublet my apartment in Oakland and moved to Northern California and started studying seriously.
You must be intuitive. Are you?
Well, I would say the plants speak to me would definitely be my life experience is that I would say that if I had to boil it down, that I was called up as an agent or a diplomat for the plants.
Because when you were young, how would you know what plants to give, you know, mix up in the teas to give your sister?
I felt at that time that there were certain, almost, sometimes I even say to my students that I feel that the classes that I teach to people are more about amnesia recovery than actually I'm introducing new information to them.
Mm-hmm.
Because humans have been using plant medicines for so long, and really neither of us would probably be here today if there wasn't somebody in our ancestry, some relative, maybe not even that distant, who knew how to identify plants in the wild, when to collect them, what to do with them to break a fever, to stimulate childbirth, you know, whatever
mm-hmm.
it may have been that kept someone alive, which led to us being here having this conversation. So it seems to me that, you know, what happens often for people is that they realize that they have this intuition about identifying plants and using them that no one ever mentioned to them before.
Well, I'd like to ask you now about parts of the plants and how you use those and how you gather them. And then after that, I'd like to talk about, ask you some questions about specific health problems that kind of everybody has.
All righty.
So how, I know some of the things you use, flowers, leaves, roots, how do you gather those and how would you use those? Does that make sense, that question?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, let me just say first that, you know, not everybody who practices herbal medicine collects and gathers and makes their own medicines. You know, maybe 50 years ago, that was definitely the truth for everybody who did plant medicines in the United States. But now, you know, the herbal industry is huge, so it's possible for people to do quite a bit with herbs without ever actually encountering the plant itself. And there are very, very effective medicines and people doing things with plants in that way. I really enjoy collecting plants myself, and you know, I'm very fortunate because I live in a very wild part of Georgia, and I spend time every day outside looking at plants and watching them go through their growth cycles. And I've written a book on the medicinal plants of the Southern Appalachians that is in some ways kind of a guide for people to know when the plant is going to be the most potent and then harvest it, because that's really the key to making effective plant medicines is being a good observer of nature. So, for example, right now, so many things are flowering. It's the last kind of hurrah out in the forest. So I'm really busy collecting plants, drying them, making alcohol extracts, which is one of the main things I use in my practice. And it's a constant thing, you know, watching the plants, noticing when their seeds are ripe, noticing when the foliage starts to die back, and then collecting them at that time, and also keeping a sharp eye out for snakes, of course, up here. I do some things with dried plants, but a lot of what I do has to do with creating what's called a tincture, which is basically an extract of a plant where you take a fresh or a dried plant and you steep it in a combination of grain alcohol, 100% alcohol, and water, and for a certain amount of time, and then strain out the herb, and then that liquid becomes your medicine, and you usually use it in drop doses.
What does it tell you when the leaves die back? Is that, and what does that tell you?
Well, For a plant, that the part that's used medicinally, if it's the root, if a plant, you know, the plants are really affected by what's happening seasonally. So when things start to change, like in the last 4 or 5 days here, our weather has really cooled off for the first time all summer. And so a lot of the plants, especially in the deep forest, their foliage is fading out now. And as soon as that starts to happen, the chi of the plant goes back into the root.
Okay.
It's stored for the winter. So the potency of the plant increases the closer you get to the frost. So between the time when the weather first starts to cool off and then there's the first frost, anything that's used as a root, that's the prime time for harvesting it.
Oh, okay. And what if you, I guess obviously, then if you use the leaves or the flowers, you want them when they're in fullest bloom?
Right, right. So okay. If it's a lot of plants, like I just got done harvesting a plant called Skullcap, which is a really nice, nerving, relaxant. It's in the mint family, and we have a lot of it in sort of open, sunny areas up here. And it just is at the end of its flowering. So for the last month, we've been harvesting a lot of that and making tinctures and drying it for teas. You know, in the spring, certain things come out. And if the part of the plant that you want primarily for the medicine is the leaf, then you want to collect that before the flower emerges, because then the plant has put all its energy into the flower, and the leaves become less important.
Okay. It's so interesting. Okay.
So it's like the peak energy, the potency of the plant, is constantly moving throughout the life cycle of the plant. And if you're a wildcrafter, which is the term we use to describe someone who collects wild medicines, you're constantly watching the plants to assess when they're at their peak potency, and then collecting them.
All right, so now I'd like to ask you about the reason I started looking for an herbalist was because something happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know me, and you looked at my website, I'm very into supplements and food, but I never knew anything about plants,
even
though I knew they were important. But recently something happened, and I went, oh, my God, I must be going through menopause.
Mm-hmm.
I got this really severe brain fog,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't put sentences together sometimes. I've been playing a couple of reruns of my show lately because I didn't think I could do a quality interview on the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't focus my sentences and my words, and I just wasn't here.
Mm-hmm.
So I went driving up and down Buford Highway. I'm sure you know where that is.
Mm-hmm.
And I found an herbalist, and he gave me something. I have no idea what it was because he was a Chinese man.
Mm-hmm.
But within 4 hours, that fog was gone.
How wonderful, Eva.
I'm going to go back tomorrow and see him and say, what did you give me? But it
and
was.
I had a lot of it because I know a lot of people who need it.
Well, he did acupuncture on me, too, so that that probably had something to
absolutely.
Do with it, too. But I was radically different in only 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to, I'm sure there are many of my listeners who go through the same thing. For somebody that you know that is starting to go through menopause and has terrible brain fog, what would you do?
Well, first of all, I'm thrilled that you have that experience. And, you know, it does catch someone's attention when something that dramatic happens.
It was radical. I couldn't believe
it.
Yeah.
The way I was trained to work as a healer is that there's no such thing as menopause or cancer or heart disease. That it all happens in the context of an individual. So I don't really know that I could say that there is one remedy or there is something that would work for everyone. You know, probably, did this person take your pulse or look at
your tongue? Yeah, he took my pulse and looked at my tongue.
Okay. So, you know, that he was looking at you particularly and seeing where the imbalance was occurring that was causing you to have that symptom. And so for you it could have been hormonal. A lot of women who have sort of poorly functioning adrenal glands is due to long-term stress, they might have that same symptom, but it could be being generated by deficiency of the adrenals or the endocrine system. For someone else, it could be set in motion by that their liver wasn't working very well. So, you know, you would see the symptom and you would definitely be trying to treat it, but in the context of what the person's body is telling you about where they're struggling.
Well, I'll use me for an example. I know that for a while I was estrogen dominant.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a bioidentical progesterone cream,
mm-hmm.
the wild yam. And for a long time, I felt a lot better. Some weight fell off. And then just all of a sudden, a couple of months ago, every time I used it, my ovaries would hurt. I don't have a uterus anymore because I didn't know what I know now and back when I got it taken out.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I've been under a lot of stress. So if I had my estrogen was low and I wanted to improve it using herbal medicines from the South, what would I use for that? And let me just say this. We're not doctors. We're only giving this for information.
Just chatting, theoretically. Well, we don't really have any plants in our region that contain what we would call phytoestrogens that the body would use or synthesize as an estrogen substitute. So the approach herbally, if you could only use regional plants, would be something that would help the liver do a better job of handling the hormones so that there was less of a tendency for hormones to be mismanaged, which is basically the job of the liver. And so we might even use something like as simple as dandelion root to do that. We also have a plant that's endemic, only found in the southern Appalachians. It's called yellow root, and it grows along the creeks. And it's an herb that helps stimulate the ability of the liver to do a better job. Of course, we have our famous black cohosh in this region, which is a remarkable herb for women with menopausal imbalances. It doesn't do anything specific to the hormones, and like a lot of herbs, we don't really know what it does in the body. But what it seems to do is regulate and harmonize the relationship between the liver and the endocrine system, particularly the adrenals, which has a very balancing effect on someone's mood.
Oh, so it's not estrogenic?
No. Mm-mm.
Okay.
No, we don't have anything here that really contains estrogen. Some people might say that red clover, Trifolium pratense, has some estrogenic compounds in it. But the thing about using hormonal supplements, and this is, you know, what the pharmaceutical industry finally came to the conclusion of, you know, very tragically in the last 5 or 10 years, is that when you superimpose a regimen on the endocrine system and you tell the hormones, you force the body to do something hormonally, you have all sorts of side effects and cancer develop. So how
do you balance chi or get it flowing?
In what context?
In this context.
In this context?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it would not, technically, most women who are going through menopause, the primary thing, and this is just based on my experience, there might be other people out there who've had a different experience, but many women who are menopausal have adrenal insufficiency. So their stress level has been such that when they reach menopause and the ovaries become less responsive to hormones in the body, everybody in the female reproductive system, you know, sort of looks to the adrenals to pick up the slack. And if someone has a lifestyle that has really stressed and exhausted the adrenal glands, where you have a woman who relies on a lot of stimulants in her diet or coffee and things like that to kind of give her a sense of energy, when that shift occurs and everybody says, okay, hit it, adrenals, nothing happens. And then that's when you start seeing women kind of fall through the floorboards. You know, you see a lot of signs of premature aging and, you know, skin dries, you have vaginal dryness, hair loss, cognitive problems, insomnia. It's almost like very quickly the vitality leaves the body because the adrenals are not able to supplement what the reproductive system had been doing.
So what would you do for that? I'm sorry.
Well, I'm very fortunately we have a lot of herbs, some in this region and just some in the herb trade in general, that are specific for restoring adrenal function. You know, you said that you had gone to someone who used traditional Chinese medicine. One of the reasons why in my classes I teach people how to use traditional Chinese medicine diagnostic techniques. So we talk about understanding what the Chinese call five-phase theory as a way of assessing someone's health. Because when you do that, what your emphasis becomes is not treating the symptom, but what the deepest underlying cause is. And Chinese medicine, to me, is so fascinating because in the cultural context of China, there was a huge emphasis on longevity and keeping people vital and, you know, functioning, highly functioning into old age. I mean, culturally, that was the culmination of someone's life, is if they could live for a long time to be venerated as an elder. And so their entire medical system is oriented around things that are slowing down the process of aging and restoring vitality. So a lot of the plants that we use are from traditional Chinese medicine. And oddly enough, I mean, this is one of the things that I think is so amazing about just, I don't know, I guess life in general, is that there's something called plant disjunction. And what it is what that refers to is that there was a forest that spread across North America into Northern Asia. And we're talking, now this is where I really kind of lose track of things, because we're talking millions of years ago, that the same community of plants inhabited that entire region. With glaciers and other climate changes, most of that forest was destroyed except for several pockets where the geography, the geology of the land was such that plant populations were preserved. One of those places was the Southern Appalachian Mountains. And by that we mean like southwestern Virginia into western North Carolina, eastern Tennessee, north Georgia, and a little bit of north Alabama. In that region, there were remnants of this ancient forest. There were also fairly large remnants of it in what is now northern China. And so what happened as a result of that is that the plants that were central to the medical system of ancient China and traditional Chinese medicine are, to a large part, the same group of plants that were used by indigenous peoples living in North America.
That's so interesting. It's overwhelming to me, though.
Yeah, it is a trip. And, you know, people didn't really realize that until the 70s, because it wasn't really until the Iron Curtain went down around China and we began to have cultural exchange and, you know, acupuncturists came to North America and people learned about traditional Chinese medicine, that plant herbalists in the United States and in Europe realized that the plants of the eastern deciduous forest were the same plants that traditional Chinese medicine was based on.
So are the plants that we have here in North America the same plants, or are they now different?
Well, of course, things are always changing. But we're talking not about North America as a continent. We're talking about the Southern Appalachians.
I guess one of the things I wanted to know is, does it help to use the plants for your body that are native to your area? Does that make a difference?
You know, in a perfect world, it would be the ideal thing to do. You know, I like to use plants that grow around me. There are theories that plants that you need for your particular health problems are already growing around you. And sometimes I find that's true. But, you know, I'm assuming you live somewhere in the Atlanta metropolitan area. So, you know, whether those plants are growing around you, even though you have a sincere need for them, might not be the case. I think that one of the things that has entered into the conversation about what plants to use is the same things that are affecting organic agriculture and agriculture as a whole, which is what can we use that's sustainable. So whenever you use the roots of a plant, you're destroying the plant, obviously. So in herbal practice, particularly in the United States, there's a huge emphasis on saying what are the plants that are abundant and that we're using the aerial parts that we can expand our understanding of how to use those plants so that we're not decimating plant populations as the demand for herbal medicines grow.
Are there people who are growing them to replace those?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's especially in Western North Carolina. There are some people also in Georgia, but Western North Carolina in our region is really leading in terms of, there's been a whole trend there to get farmers who had formerly grown commodity crops like tobacco to do small-scale agriculture of medicinal plants for the herb industry because this is their native habitat. So it's uniquely suited for growing these plants. The plants of this region that I'm talking about are also some of the top commercially sold plants in the world. So when I go to Greece, for example, last time I was in Greece, I ran into a friend of mine who was going through menopause, and it was a kind of a cold day, and she had on the tiniest shirt I've ever seen on a human being. And she's a very modest person, so it was kind of shocking to see her with this little, you know, spaghetti strap shirt on and a business suit, but it's like obviously trying to dress coolly. And she looked terrible, and she told me that she was having such severe night sweats and hot flashes that she had not slept in about 8 months. So I went around the corner to this minuscule health food store that's in the village where I live over there, and I asked them if they had any black cohosh, and the guy went in the back and he came out with like two jars of capsules of black cohosh, and he acted as if he was bringing out gold nuggets to sell me because they were very expensive and they were very hard for him to get, and I bought them for her, and I tried to tell him that where I live in the North Georgia Mountains, this was a very common weed. It grows everywhere around my house in the woods. And he really didn't believe me because to him it was just this amazingly rare plant that he had managed to get a small supply of. So our plants in this region are used throughout the world because they're some of the most effective medicines.
Could you explain to me what it means to talk about heat and cool in herbal medicine?
I'm sorry, heat and cool?
Yeah. I was reading in a book, and it talked about whether your symptoms were from heat in Chinese medicine,
uh-huh.
If they were heat-related or cold-related or cool-related.
Okay.
I don't understand a lot of this, but I want to understand it.
Okay, well, I'll tell you everything I know in the next 20 minutes. How's that?
Okay.
Okay. Well, let me just kind of contrast. In the way herbal medicine has traditionally been practiced in Europe, that whole system of herbal medicine is based on sort of the same understanding of the body that allopathic doctors use, is to think about the body in terms of systems. So you have the respiratory system and the urinary system and cardiovascular system. And so herbs are sort of organized according to what body system they seem to affect in some way. And in that context, herbs are talked about as having specific actions. So it might be a cardiovascular stimulant. It might be a liver tonic. It might be an expectorant. It might be a diuretic that has an action on a specific body part. And that is although it's an effective way to use plant medicines, ultimately it's fairly mechanistic. So it sort of assumes that the body is kind of a machine that you would manipulate in some way using a specific herb that's going to force the body to do something. So in that model, if you came to me and you had brain fog, I might use something that increased the circulation to your brain to hopefully wake you up a little more and help you think more clearly. In traditional Chinese medicine, they have what's called the eight parameters. And so instead of talking about a body system that's out of balance, they would talk about that you have either deficient qi or excessive qi, that your symptoms were either internal or external, that they were generating excessive dampness or excessive dryness, and or the last category would be that they were causing you to have excessive cold symptoms or excessive heat symptoms. So a Chinese practitioner would listen to everything that you were telling them about how you were feeling, and they would sort of create a description for themselves that you were perhaps experiencing deficient heat symptoms internally that were causing excessive dampness. And then they would look for herbs that dispel dampness and increase the body temperature that were warming. So the symptoms are rated according to those eight parameters. And then all herbs are sort of rated on a scale between hot, warm, neutral, cool, or cold. The hot and the cold characterized herbs are used to treat really acute symptoms. So when someone's burning up with a fever or has an infection, you would use a very cold herb. If they were very chilled and experiencing a lot of dampness and you were worried about their...
What do you mean dampness? Is that inside or outside? Is that sweating?
Inside.
Okay. What do you mean by that? Like something in your lungs or... What does that
mean? Like if someone had, let's say you'd had a bad cold, and now you're really recovered from the cold, but you still have a lot of mucus in your lungs.
Oh, okay.
And
I gotcha.
That mucus is no longer, you don't have an active infection, which would be hot, be excessive heat. Now you have all this cold congestion in your lungs, and you need something that's warming and stimulating to help you cough it up and get it out. So you would then look at herbs that were warm or hot to use to treat a cold or cool symptom.
So you use the opposite?
Yeah, you balance.
Oh, okay. Oh, of course.
So what that is, the traditional Chinese medicine is based on what we would call energetics.
That makes so much sense just for you to say that to me.
Okay.
To balance, everything is yin and yang, I guess. Okay.
Well, you know, yin and yang are just two terms that are a way of comparing things.
Uh-huh.
So,
or what is the word? Binary, how's that?
Binary, you could say that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A differential diagnosis, you know. And then, you know, with every person that you talk to, there's what's normal for them. And this is like where I think a lot of people get so poorly treated by allopathic medicine is that so often people know that something's not right. They don't feel right, and they go to the doctor, and they have a physical, or they have a blood test, And the doctor says, well, you know, everything looks fine. And then the person somewhere down the line, you know, develops some, you know, terrible disease process that in Chinese medicine or in a more energetic system, your knowing that something was off, like you saying, there's brain fog, and this is not how I usually am, you could have gone to someone who could have assessed you and said, well, you know, it's menopause, it's going to happen, what can we say? But energetically, you were off.
I thought I was either dying or getting Alzheimer's coming
right.
on quickly.
Right, and that's a
And it was really serious. I didn't feel like I was safe to drive a car.
Sure.
You know, I mean, it was really serious, and whatever he did, and the only thing he did, well, I did use Norm Shealy's new machine. I don't know if you know about that, but I didn't use it in the way that he said, so I don't know if it really did anything or not. It's that one that vibrates up at 50,000 hertz. I just kind of didn't use the electrodes or anything. I just laid it on my head.
Okay.
But it was after I went and got the acupuncture and those herbs.
Mm-hmm.
And within 3 hours,
mm-hmm.
I was sane again. I feel safe driving a car.
I'm so happy for you.
It was amazing. I just want everybody else to know. That's why I want you to come back so I can read your book and ask more intelligent questions, because this was done on the spur of the moment. But you're doing a great job helping me. Thank you. I was so happy to find you. Okay, another question that I have is the five flavors plus bland. What is that about?
The five flavors? Well, that's another way to classify what herbs are going to do in the body. So when you taste an herb that's been prepared as a tea, it will have one of five flavors, and the flavor is going to affect a specific one of the or a specific organ or a specific element in the body. So how a formula is put together in traditional Chinese medicine is, again, to introduce the flavor that's going to affect the organ that seems to be out of balance. I don't know what more to say about that, except that there's receptors on the tongue. And
oh, okay.
When your body, when you experience a taste on your tongue, it
correlates with an organ.
Physiological response somewhere in the body.
Okay, that makes sense to me.
So,
I'm kind of
really
science-oriented, so I understand it when you say it that way.
Okay, you know, like the taste of bitterness. And what's interesting, I'm glad you brought this up, because I just did a talk a few weeks ago about the importance of bitterness. One of the flavors that's completely missing from the American diet, to a large degree, we see a little bit of it in some cases with cooked greens, especially in the South,
mm-hmm.
is the taste of bitterness. And just about every traditional cuisine has bitter foods in it.
Is that this book that I'm looking at says acrid, sweet, bitter, dry, sour. What is acrid?
What's acrid?
What flavor would that be?
Let's see here. Turmeric would be considered acrid.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I think he must have given me bitter then.
Like a chemical over.
Okay.
After sex.
Okay, that makes sense to me. Because what he gave me was hard to drink.
Right. That's what Chinese medicine is famous.
But I have a question now. I put stevia in it. Is that going to mess it up?
Probably not.
Okay.
No.
It was pretty bad.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that is, you know, traditional Chinese medicine, you know, for the people have to be pretty convinced of the value before they'll go along with it, because it is pretty challenging. And, you know, if you take someone who has come from a lifetime of thinking about medicines as something that comes in a sterile white bottle with a piece of pure cotton and tamper-proof top, and then you hand them a bundle of sticks and twigs, tell them to go home and boil that for 20 minutes and drink it, you know, that's a huge paradigm shift.
Uh-huh.
You know, not everyone can make the leap.
So you just said that when you drink the tea or the herb or whatever it is, when you take
uh-huh.
it, that flavor stimulates taste buds on your tongue that correlates with an organ. So if I take away that flavor by putting stevia in it, I'm not messing it up?
Well, you're probably getting less value than you would if you were tasting it. And you know, it's
okay.
Kind of a trade-off. Would you drink it without the stevia?
I will, but...
You would. Okay.
But
well,
I didn't know what you just told me, so you just, you know, taught
yeah,
me something.
Yeah, I would, you know, if you were my client, I would say if it's possible for you to drink it without sweetening it, that's part of the therapy.
That's just
but
amazing.
If I have someone
never
who says,
thought about
I cannot
that.
Tolerate this unless I put some stevia in it, I would go for at least they're getting it in their body and it, the herbs are going to do more than just stimulate the tongue. They're going to have a whole other, you know, once they get into the gut, they're going to do a bunch of other things. So it's still worth my while.
Okay.
You know, compliance is a big thing in herbal medicine. You know, you can have all these fabulous theories about what someone should do, but if the taste makes them nauseous and they don't do it, well, then what's the point?
That's just so fascinating to me. I had no idea that it had anything to do, like you said, treating the opposites and the tongue. I had no idea about that.
Uh-huh.
Wakes
yeah.
me up a lot. Okay. What would you do as everybody here in our country has cholesterol issues? How would you treat that?
Well,
that's something
I'm going to take off to some degree by saying it's pretty unique per person, for each person. A lot of people who have elevated cholesterol have that as a result of unmitigated stress. And there's a direct correlation between high cholesterol and stress levels. You know, culturally, we're in a context right now where the main thing that I, as a practitioner, am treating are the effects of long-term stress. People are, you know, stretched to the max in every way possible. And so I'm not looking so much at controlling infectious disease and dealing with congenital health problems, acute conditions, as much as things that are what in Tibetan medicine they would call diseases of conduct, something that has occurred through lifestyle choices that have gone on for an extended period of time that have now weakened the immune system, rattled the nervous system, shook up the endocrine system, and people are really on the edge. You had told me that you looked at that book, Adaptogens, by my colleague David Winston,
mm-hmm.
and the whole idea of using herbs as a method to help people adapt to sustained stress is one of the main things herbalists are working with right now. There are lots of herbs, again, drawn from a lot of them from traditional Chinese medicine, which has such a well-developed understanding of how plants can keep people from being depleted.
What about that
approach is really one of the main things that I'm working with in my practice just because that's who's coming to me.
What about children? And that, so I guess to back up for a second, you would treat the adrenals for that?
That would be one part of it. And again, you know, it would really depend on the person. Usually what you see is that all of us have constitutional strengths and weaknesses based on our ancestral heritage. You know, we come from people who have great hearts or poor hearts or, you know, liver problems or kidney disease or whatever is in our family history of health. And when someone is highly stressed, that stress is going to affect whatever's the weakest organ in the body. So for some person, it might be the function of their heart. For someone else, it might be their digestion.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, so yeah.
For you
so conditioning, really.
Symptom, but what's the constitutional context that that's occurring in?
What about children who have ADHD or ADD? I mean, constantly complaining to my school, the people at the administration at my kids' school about trying to get people to put their kids on Ritalin.
Uh-huh.
How would you address that?
Well, I can just get up on my soapbox for you for a minute if you want.
That would be fun. Because I feel the same way.
In fact, I just this morning saw that, I think it was this morning or yesterday morning, that the New York Times had this article that just really got me going for the day, that they have now decided that preschoolers are suffering from depression, that there's this new syndrome of depression in preschoolers, and that doctors are, you know, trying to figure out what they're going to do to treat these preschoolers who are clearly showing signs of clinical depression.
And we know what they'll do. They'll write in prescriptions for pharmaceuticals.
Right.
We don't have enough money yet.
There's so much evidence that, you know, what the drug industry does is develop a drug and then look for something that they can treat with it, which is obscene as far as I'm concerned. But to not go too far down that road, I believe that most of the children who are being classified now as having ADD or ADHD are suffering from what in traditional Chinese medicine is called a Shen disturbance. And a Shen disturbance is where the...
How do you spell that? What is that?
S-H-E-N.
Oh, okay.
Shen.
Gotcha.
So in Chinese medicine, there's a belief that the spirit, or the, not really the soul, but kind of the spirit that animates the body, is vulnerable to emotional shock. And so... when someone experiences something, a loss of a loved one, or they see something, a tragic accident happen, that affects their Shen. And how well they can process that experience, the Shen will then settle back down again. So just like you would experience a shock after something emotional happens, that's the equivalent of a Shen disturbance. The spirit is disturbed. When someone has a severe Shen disturbance, they can even, you know, develop what we would classify as mental illness, because the spirit cannot settle back down fully in the body, and they can't concentrate. They can't kind of show up in this reality. And what some of my teachers have said about Shen disturbance is just what I'm going to pass on to you and what I use in my practice, which is that through exposure to media, television, movies, and God forbid, video games, children who don't have a cultural context for processing emotions are exposed to things like violence, death, things that would really disturb you emotionally, but it's happening to them alone, sitting in a room looking at a television. It's not happening in the context of their family the same way it would be if a grandparent died and everybody was sharing that reality. So you have these children who are being exposed to things they're not emotionally prepared for. It disturbs the Shen, and the Shen is what's responsible for your ability to be present and have healthy cognitive function and to be able to assimilate information and order it in some way.
How would you treat that?
Well, the main thing that I treat is what I call protection from harshness, which is this happens with adults and with children, is that I would say absolutely no media exposure. You know, I've had people that I've said, you know, have someone on call to let you know if the end of the world is happening. And other than that, you're not to turn on any kind of computer news, television, radio, anything where you could be exposed to upsetting news that doesn't have any impact on your own life.
So we got about 5 minutes.
Okay.
Imagine someone is already to that point.
Okay.
They're already emotionally disturbed.
They're having the Shen disturbance.
How do you heal it? They're severely traumatized. How do you treat to get the healing process going?
Well, I would protect them from anything shocking, and then I would use herbs that would restore the function of the heart in particular. I would use essential oils. I would make them, I would strongly suggest they spend time in nature, surrounded by the color of green, which is very soothing to the heart and the shin. And I would treat them the same as I would if I had a three-month-old infant in the house. No loud noises, no shocking experiences, everything soothing, calm, and safe.
That's so interesting. My son just got back from Iraq, and he's very sick. And that's really interesting to me.
Yeah, that's probably one of the things that's happening for him, I would imagine, because
mm-hmm.
that would be a very challenging environment for someone to stay present in.
And herbs, what kind of herbs would you use?
Nerving tonics, things that
okay.
restore the nervous system. You know, we would also try to help calm the adrenals because they would be involved. And a lot of things that affect the heart, hawthorn berries, and there's an herb called linden flowers that are very soothing and calming to the heart.
Okay, you have about 4 minutes. What do you want to talk about that we haven't already talked about? Anything you want to talk about?
Well, I guess I would just want to tell your listeners that to make them feel hopeful about the role that plant medicines could play in their lives. I have seen amazing things happen in people's lives with restoring their birthright, which is to have a relationship with the plants as a source of healing. Plant medicines work very slowly and deeply in the body. It's not something that happens in most cases overnight. I know you've experienced something happening very quickly, but you know it'll probably be a cumulative effect of working with that person for a while for you to see a full recovery. But I take great hope from the kinds of things that happen when people slow down, brew some tea, incorporate plants into their lives on a daily basis. And I'm on a mission to bring that awareness to more and more people.
Thank you. That's all I know to say. Somebody sent me an email about that festival that we were talking about at the Land Trust.
Uh-huh. The Evolver Fest, yeah.
Yeah, and I saw your picture, and I went, I got to go see that lady. I need to know that lady. I want to know that lady. So we went there that day, and we drove all around the streets. You know, there's no parking places.
Right.
And I got frustrated, and as you know, it was very hot. And I couldn't find a parking place, but then I just came home. But I knew that there was something that I needed for you to tell my listeners.
Well, I've enjoyed talking to you, Eva.
Well, thank you. And when I get your book, please come back because I feel like I can do a better job asking questions.
Well, may your healing continue.
But you did a great job, and I thank you. I really do. Thank you. And
right.
I'll speak to you soon.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health.
Integral Health.
Integral Health. You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health. Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m. to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Harris.